And there are wise and insightful people without any highbrow education. You can also find a few who have both education and wisdom. It's up to you to choose solid, reliable teachers. Not so that you can substitute their thinking for your own, but so you can add to your personal knowledge. If you have ever been involved in any sort of organization, you know what I'm saying. Some authority comes from the shiny nameplate on the door, and then there are those whose influence, simply but powerfully, comes from the fact that they just know the ropes. Your job, of course, is to find sources of information and influence whose credibility is not a function of a nameplate on a door, but instead is proof of the fact that however they gain the knowledge, they in fact do know the ropes. Fortunately, there are those kinds of people around. I am sure that you have encountered them in your life, and maybe have even been that person who knew the ropes. Think back. Early into a new job, when you were still the new kid, someone may have said to you, "Stick close to that old gray dog over there. He knows the ropes around here." What people respected about Gray Dog, or GD as you might have called him, was that he, or she, understood that particular system and how to make it work for rather than against the people in it. Better than anyone else, this person knew the rules, the beliefs, the biases, and the guidelines that drove that particular system. Now, your office wall may have been cluttered with diplomas, your first week's work clothes may have cost more than GD made in a month, but no matter how sophisticated your background, no matter how much expertise you thought you were bringing to your new position, you learned pretty quickly that GD had wisdom. When the power goes off or the computer network crashes, don't bother telling the specialist, just call GD. He'll know whom to contact and what to say. When the copier people say that they can't possibly service the machine until next week at the earliest, have GD call them. She gets results, or she may know just where to kick it herself. And when layoffs are imminent, somehow GD is going to be the first to know the details. While other people at the job know things, GD's particular expertise lies in the human behaviors that govern that workplace. Early into that new job, you learned that if you could just know what he knew, you would avoid breaking a rule, written or otherwise, embarrassing yourself, and alienating the boss. He could tell you what the higher-ups were looking for in an employee. He could tell you what they needed to see and hear from you in order to decide that you were okay. He could tell you the rules of the game, some written, some, usually the most important ones, not. He might even share with you the secret formula to get ahead. GD's experience had given him knowledge, and that knowledge made him powerful. He had learned to work the system. That's how he got to be so gray. He knew what you could get away with and what you couldn't. He had studied the policy manual. More importantly, he had observed how the real world worked. GD had broken the code. Now, you may be that person at your job, or you may know someone who is. There's an old GD just about everywhere. You see him in prison movies. He's the older guy with the watchful eyes, slouching by the wall, saying very little. He's in movies about the police force, or the mafia, or the battlefield. He knows the politics, and he knows when to push and when to give. He knows how to stay alive. You can find him in the corporate cafeteria, and you can find him living under the bridge among the homeless. There's always that person who can reliably tell you, "I don't care what they say, or what you believe, or what you learned in school, or what you thought it ought to be. I'm telling you how it is." Now, I'm more of a bald dog than a gray dog, but if you're willing to learn, I'm ready to tell you how it is. I do know the bottom line, and I've worked long and hard for that knowledge. I want to save you the trial and error I had to go through to get it. To the extent that life has a policy manual, I've read it backward and forward. Just as importantly, however, I've made it my business to understand the push and pull of human behavior. I have paid careful attention to the social hydraulics that are affecting your life right now. For example, creating a strategy for Oprah's trial is a recent example of how I use the edge of knowledge to bring about a desired result. I had to develop a strategy that would get people to embrace her view of the events in question. To do that, I had to know what was important to those jurors and what to emphasize to get them to conclude rightly. The strategy had nothing to do with duping a jury or creating some smoke and mirrors defense. The strategy was to get 12 intelligent, moral people to overcome any misguided loyalty they may have felt towards these millionaire factory cattlemen and to deal with the truth as it really was. Now, I know Texas, and I know people in general are suspicious of those they don't live with, work with, worship with, and grow up with. We had to meet that jury where they were in terms of what they believed, and yet persuade them to move their position to our way of thinking. You must understand someone and know what makes them tick before you can connect with them. They need to see similarities between you and your values and their own. That is the basis of bonding. As a result, we had to figure out the same kinds of things you will have to know to effectively deal with the people you hope to influence in your life. Whether it's your children, your spouse, your boss, or others, you have to know them to move them. How do you do that? You have to realize that we share the same basic fears and needs. Obviously, if you know these common characteristics of human functioning, you can use them in your strategic planning for yourself and others. I constantly use these common characteristics in formulating strategies that involve not just jurors, but people in all walks of life. Write these things on the back of your hand if you have to, because incorporating them into your social interactions will change the course of your life starting right now. The 10 most significant common characteristics of human functioning that I have identified are: Number 1. The number one fear among all people is rejection. Number 2. The number one need among all people is acceptance. Number 3. To manage people effectively, you must do it in a way that protects or enhances their self-esteem. Number 4. Everybody, and I mean everybody, approaches every situation with at least some concern about what's in it for me. Number 5. Everybody, and I mean everybody, prefers to talk about things that are important to them personally. Number 6. People hear and incorporate only what they understand. Number 7. People like, trust, and believe those who like them. Number 8. People often do things for other than the apparent reasons. Number 9. Even people of quality can be and often are petty and small. Number 10. Everybody, and once again I mean everybody, wears a social mask. You must look beyond the mask to see the person. Having heard this list, you may be thinking, boy, this guy is a pessimist about people. Not true. I'm not a pessimist. I'm a realist. I'm just telling you how it is. And if you will honestly assess your experience, you will find that you, just like me, are living proof that those 10 observations are accurate. In fact, to ignore these givens about human behavior would be wrong thinking. Wrong thinking can seal your fate before you even begin. Failure is no accident. You set yourself up for it or you don't. You can and will avoid failure if you use this information in your attempts to manage yourself and others. Try a simple experiment tomorrow by testing a few of the common characteristics on our list. For example, take characteristic number 2. The number one need among all people is acceptance. It can be tested quite easily. Say you're in a restaurant and service is slow. When the waiter finally gets to you, try saying something like, "Boy, I can't believe they have you running so hard and fast today. As fast as you're going, you need roller skates. We really appreciate your getting to us." Now, as superficial as that may sound, give it a try. I think you will come away concluding that my list of common characteristics was not put together indiscriminately. You may be thinking that I'm teaching you how to be manipulative. You're right. Manipulation is not in and of itself a bad thing. The fact is, I am attempting to manipulate you right now. I say that openly and freely, and I make no apology for it. Manipulation is only a bad thing if it is insidious, selfish, or exploitive. But if I can manipulate you into learning about becoming and in actually being a more effective individual, mother, father, husband, or wife, what is there to complain about? That kind of manipulation is a good thing, particularly since I'm telling you up front that I'm engaging in it. And let's not forget that there is one kind of manipulation that reigns supreme. Even more important than having the knowledge to predict human behavior or control other people is having the knowledge to predict and control yourself. Knowing how to be an effective manager of others can be helpful, but it is exponentially more important to be an effective manager of yourself. No matter where or in what circumstances you encounter people, the one common denominator in all of those situations is you. The person you spend the most time with is you. The person you most need the power to influence and control is you. The person whose negative characteristics and behavior patterns you most need the power to minimize or eliminate, and whose positive characteristics and behavior patterns you most need to maximize, is you. The paramount issue is that you have to understand how you work from the inside out. You have to understand what makes you feel the way you feel. To state this in terms of life law number one, you either get it or you don't. Immerse yourself into the process of learning the next 9 life laws, and you will become a member of the Gets It Club. Let's hope you have given your last Sam Sausage answer to the questions of life. Life law number 2, you create your own experience. Your strategy? Acknowledge and accept accountability for your life. Understand your role in creating the results that are your life. Learn how to choose better so you have better. The law is simple. You are accountable for your life. Good or bad, successful or unsuccessful, happy or sad, fair or unfair, you own your life. You are now accountable. You have always been accountable. You will always be accountable. That's how it is. That may not be how you want it to be, but that's how it is. Please understand, I'm not talking about this as a general proposition. I am not presenting this as a theory. I am telling you that you create the results in your life, not some of the time, but all of the time. If you don't like your job, you're accountable. If your relationships are on the rocks, you are accountable. If you are overweight, you are accountable. If you don't trust members of the opposite sex, you are accountable. If you are not happy, you are accountable. Let me tell you why this is so important. If you don't accept accountability, you will misdiagnose every problem you have. If you misdiagnose, you will mistreat. If you mistreat, things won't get better, plain and simple. Even if you think there can't possibly be a link between your problems and yourself, assume I am right and keep digging for your role in the problems. It is there. I promise you. Trust me. We need to call time out at this point because I want you to understand what's at stake. If you fail to accept this law and continue to perceive the world and react to it as a victim, clinging to the belief that you are right, so the problem can't be your fault, you will not successfully create meaningful and lasting change in your life. Don't let this be some dry rhetoric. Listen to what I'm saying. If in any part of your life you are angry, hurt, or upset, then you own those feelings and are accountable for their presence in your life. There is more than one way to play the victim. You can insist that someone is being mean or unfair or ugly to you. Another way, in fact the most common way, is to believe that you are right in your position, those who disagree with you are wrong, and therefore it is not your fault that things are at an impasse. But even if you are right and they are wrong, you still have ownership of the problem. My question to you would be, if you're so right, if you're so smart, then why can't you create the results that you want? You can answer, they just won't listen. And again, I would say, you own the fact that they won't listen. The fact that they won't listen is a direct result of your inability to get them to hear you. Bottom line, you are not a victim. You are creating the situations you are in. You are creating the emotions that flow from those situations. This is not theory, it is life. You must be willing to move your position, and however difficult or unusual it may seem, embrace the fact that you own the problem. That is not all bad news. Accepting your role in your problems, acknowledging that you are accountable, means that you get it. It means that you understand that the solutions lie within you. While everybody else is still out there blaming those who aren't responsible for the results in their life, you can be as on target as a laser-guided missile, and therefore work only on those things that will truly change your life. That gives you a tremendous head start in the solution category. Let today be a huge wake-up call for you. Quit looking in the wrong place for answers. The immediate impact that I want this law to have is that it causes you to look in the one right place, not a million wrong ones, for the solutions to your problems. You need to stop saying, "Why are they doing this to me?" and start saying, "Why am I doing this to myself? What thoughts, behaviors, and choices can I change to get a different result?" As we move through this audiobook, we will be creating and preparing your life by design. We are creating your strategic approach to living the life and getting the results that you want. Recognizing your own accountability is a crucial building block in that strategy. Absorb this awareness into the core of your soul starting right now. Express that resolve in the way you analyze the events in your life. Then, looking ahead, express it in the choices that you make. Keep the focus where it belongs, on your own choices and behaviors, and in the here and now. Once you understand the life laws that control your life and make it what it is, you'll tell yourself, "I have no reason to expect that my life would be anywhere else than where it is." I know that this train of thought is at odds with conventional thinking. Certainly, it contradicts almost every behavioral explanation that society currently offers. Books abound about toxic families, dysfunctional families, and the crippling aftermath of childhood abuse, whether sexual, verbal, or physical. The books tell you that your childhood was stolen and your inner child is locked up and wants out. When we read things that, however they are disguised, send the message that you are not accountable, we feel relieved, at least for the moment. We desperately want to believe these books because they seem to lighten our load. Your best chance to get real control of your life is to stop that thinking right now. Don't try to place accountability somewhere else, or you are going to continue to cripple any efforts you are making towards becoming a winner. Imagine losing your keys and looking all over the house to find them. You look in every drawer, pocket, nook, and cranny, high and low. You go to heroic lengths to find those keys. You transform yourself into an expert key hunter. Now suppose that the keys are actually outside in the ignition of your car. No matter how thoroughly, no matter how hard or how long you look, you will never find those keys in the house because they aren't there. Likewise, when you set out to find the causes to your problems in other people, you will never find them because they aren't there. The answers are in you. You will never, ever fix your problems blaming someone else. That is for losers. Don't be a sucker just because it hurts to admit the truth. You're the one screwing up, if anybody is. The sooner you accept that, the sooner your life gets better. But you need to understand an important point about this law. I didn't say you are to blame. I said you are accountable, as in responsible. There's a huge difference between blame and responsibility. To deserve blame, you must have intended your actions or recklessly disregarded their consequences. By contrast, responsibility simply means that you were in control, that you had a choice. Accountability or responsibility does not imply intent or recklessness. It says only that you did, or allowed to be done, whatever led to the outcome. If I am roughhousing with my friends and jump on a chair with both feet and break it, I have at best shown a reckless disregard for the chair. I am responsible for the damage, and I can justly be blamed for it. Now suppose I simply sit down on the chair and it breaks. I am responsible for the damage. I was using the chair properly and had no intent to destroy it. So I am not to be blamed as though I had maliciously destroyed it, but yet I am still responsible. Now we must give consideration to things that happened to us as children. I realize that certain realities, some of them horribly sick realities, are visited upon us when we are children. I am not suggesting that as children we choose all of the events and circumstances in our lives. We don't pick our parents. We are neither responsible nor accountable for being raped, abused, or molested. That is not what I am saying. What I am saying to you is that while you may not have had the knowledge or power as a child to make certain choices, and are therefore not accountable for those events, as an adult, you do have the ability to choose your reaction to those childhood events and circumstances. You must accept the premise that the only time is now. The past is over and the future hasn't happened yet. Sitting there at this specific moment as an adult, you and only you can choose your reaction to the events of your earlier life. Is it fair that you have to deal with that? No. Is it fair that you have to live with it and manage it for the rest of your life? No. Are you nevertheless accountable for how you live with it and how you manage it? Absolutely. I suppose that your accountability is both good news and bad news. The bad news is that the burden is on you. The good news is that the choice is yours. Because this law of accountability is so fundamental and so outcome determinative, let's examine the actual method by which you create your own experience. You create your own experience by and through the choices you make every day. This choice-making acts to create your own experience because with every choice you make comes a certain consequence. Specifically, when you choose the behavior, you choose the consequences. When you choose the thoughts, you choose the consequences. When you choose the thoughts, you choose the physiology. Simply put, when you play, you pay. whatever choices you make in this world, those choices have results. Those results accumulate to define the experience that you have of this world. Those results are your experience. If you choose really stupid behavior, you are likely to experience severe negative consequences. If you choose to live recklessly and without regard to personal safety, you choose the likely consequence of pain and injury. If you choose the behavior of staying with a sick and destructive partner, then you choose the consequence of pain and suffering in your emotional life. Your thoughts are behavior too. Choosing thoughts contributes to your experiences because when you choose your thoughts, you choose consequences that are associated with those thoughts. If you choose thoughts that demean and depreciate you, then you choose the consequence of low self-esteem and low self-confidence. If you choose thoughts contaminated with anger and bitterness, then you will create an experience of alienation, isolation, and hostility. We cannot discuss consequences without also mentioning the mind-body connection. There's a powerful connection here. Your physiology determines your energy and action level. If your internal dialogue is negative and self-effacing, then the physiology that simultaneously occurs will be just as negative. Your depressed thoughts suppress energy and action. Your body will conform to that central computer message. You are mentally, behaviorally, and physiologically programming yourself to go through life in a particular way. We have spoken generally about the fact that when you choose the behavior or thought, you choose the consequences. Now let's examine some of the specific mechanisms of interaction that create results in your life. One of the most important choices you make, and make daily, is how you present and define yourself to other people. Everybody has a certain way of being in the world. Everybody has a look. Everybody has an attitude. Everybody has a certain role and demeanor that they choose when dealing with others. Some might call it your personality. Some might call it your style. This is particularly important for you to attend to because when you engage other people in a certain way, they are most apt to respond in a related fashion. That means that every day, as you make these and hundreds of other choices, you contribute to your experience of the world. These choices define how the world in turn reacts to you. Let's look more closely at how this process works, particularly through the principle of reciprocity. Put simply, reciprocity means that you get what you give. The manner, style, and level you use to engage people will determine how they respond to you. You experience reciprocity at the most basic level every day. You casually encounter someone you know, and that person says, "Hey, how you doing?" And you respond, "Fine, and you?" And he or she predictably responds, "Fine, just fine." No surprises there. Casual, superficial, polite exchanges. It is rare that such an interaction would include one or the other of these casual conversationalists bursting into tears and saying that the night before last they caught their spouse in bed with some homewrecker. That kind of exchange would be entirely out of place when someone has just politely and superficially engaged another. Typically and predictably, you get what you give. There are an infinite number of styles, ways, and levels with which we deal with others, and we may choose different ones in various situations. But there is invariably a pattern that defines who you are in the eyes of the world. The aggregate of those interactions is what defines other people's reaction to you and therefore your experience of the world. People do have a style. You have a style, a way of being. You hear people describe others by noting their persona. "He's a real hard charger," or "she's a cool customer." Some approach life as a combat. They're hostile, even explosive. Others are milquetoast who expect to get trampled, and do. Your attitude of approach dictates what you get back. You may complain about the way people react to you, but believe me, you create it, just as everyone else creates the reactions they get from the world. Honestly evaluate your style of engagement, and you will begin to understand why the world responds to you as it does. To help you, here are some examples of engagement styles to which the world reciprocates very predictably. You may find yourself here, or you may have to create your own category. The porcupine. These people just seem to have a chip on their shoulder. They walk into every situation expecting to be offended. They're determined to find fault with anything and everything going on around them. No matter what the situation, they're quick to personalize any act or statement as offensive to their sensibilities. They're prickly. Trying to get close to them is like trying to hug a porcupine. As a result, people engage them, if at all, at arm's length. The world recognizes that interacting with the porcupine is a lose-lose proposition. Porcupines typically complain about how cold people are around them. They're baffled by other people's standoffishness. Porcupines don't seem to understand that they act in that way and that people are simply responding in kind. Next, we have the paws-up personality. We've all encountered dogs that have been so mistreated that when you approach them, they just lie down, flop over on their back, and put their paws in the air. Some people act in the same way. It's my fault. I screwed up. I deserve a whipping, so let me assume the position. They communicate to the world their understanding that in every situation, there are whippers and whippies, and they expect to be the whippie. These people invite the world to wail on them. Paws-up people have made it clear that there's a pecking order and they expect to be on the bottom. The world will gladly accommodate. At the other end of the continuum is the king or queen of the forest. These people communicate to those around them that they are unwashed peasants who are fortunate to be in the presence of a truly big deal. They are legends in their own minds. These people discuss their own business, activities, and events as though these things are of cliffhanger interest to everyone around. To say these people are arrogant and self-important may not go far enough. Kings and queens of the forest are genuinely convinced that the entire universe revolves around them. In response, the world reacts to them with resentment. Family members and co-workers will often sabotage the king or queen using covert, passive-aggressive behavior. For example, when it starts to rain, nobody bothers to tell the king or queen that he or she has left the car windows down. Kings and queens of the forest have no inkling that they are creating an experience in which people gleefully celebrate their demise. Next is the poser. Posers might as well be mannequins in a department store window. They act in the most superficial manner imaginable. They behave as if stupidity were a virtue and superficiality divine. Their goal is to look better than you and make sure you know it. They spend most of their time striking poses and using phony self-criticisms to elicit compliments. Trying to make a poser feel secure is like trying to fill a bottomless pit. Because they insist on engaging the world superficially, posers create an experience devoid of genuineness and intimacy. Next is the people eater. People eaters have one elegantly simple goal: to control everyone and everything. They intend to manage your life, their lives, and anything and everything that you have the misfortune of sharing with them. They dominate all of their interactions. People eaters will tell you what you think and how you feel. They will use you and everyone around them to get what they want. If you or anyone else becomes a casualty, that's a minor inconvenience. The people eater will just get someone else. In this respect, people eaters have an insatiable appetite. Because they engage the world in this fashion, people eaters' relationships are entirely, painfully one-sided. Other people's responses to them are characterized by rebellion, rejection, or resentful passivity. Ultimately, the people leader's experience of life is one of frustration and loneliness. And then there's the ever-popular drama queen. For these hysterics, none of life's events, even the ordinary ones, are ordinary. Every sickness they have is the worst the doctor has ever seen. Every fender bender becomes a fiery crash in their retelling of it. Every comment made to them is either the sweetest, warmest thing they've ever heard, or the rudest, most vicious attack imaginable. These people could create drama from watching paint dry. They engage the world in such a way as to sacrifice all credibility. Those around them soon recognize their histrionics and discount anything and everything they say. Nothing remains of the drama queen's ability to be taken seriously in any situation. Their experience is marked by ineffectiveness and lots of smiles and nods. In a victim-packed society, we cannot forget the victims. These people are accountable for nothing. Everything is done to them, not by them or with them or for them. They see themselves as captives on the evil train of life, and all the other passengers are out to get them. Victims are whiners, criers, and blamers. The world quickly tires of their hangdog ways and has absolutely no respect for their competency as human beings. Their experience is marked by passivity, a lack of control, and the inability to overcome obstacles. Einstein analyzers are next. These know-it-alls epitomize the observation that analysis is paralysis. Dissecting every situation to the point of complete tedium, they entirely miss the essence of any situation in which they participate, and therefore of life in general. They engage the world in such a way that they are seen as intelligent but impractical. Because their over-analysis bores people, analyzers are typically avoided. They create an experience characterized by colorless living and an absence of bonding. One of the most dangerous types is the conspirator gossip. Conspirator gossips are always looking over their shoulders and whispering to you some gripping truth that they alone know and will share only with you. They are viewed as untrustworthy busybodies. The world quickly recognizes that if the conspirator gossip will tell it to you, they'll also tell it about you. People treat them in the most guarded fashion. No one wants to provide them with the information that will become the topic of their next top-secret meeting. Ultimately, conspirator gossips are shamed. They self-destruct by repeatedly trying to create a bond, trust, and intimacy at the expense of others. And then there's the yeah buts. Of all the animals ever to walk vertically and use thumbs, these people may be the most frustrating. No matter what you say, no matter what solution you offer, no matter what you have to contribute, their response is always, "Yeah, but," followed by a myriad of reasons why your contributions cannot and will not work. Because an encounter with them can be so frustrating, people avoid them like sour milk. They give frustration and they get frustration. They create an experience that puts them at odds with the world and everyone in it. Ever famous is the Scarlett O'Haras of the world. Faced with difficulties, these people choose not to address them. "I'll think about that tomorrow," they say. "Tomorrow is another day." The world disregards these Scarlett O'Haras with a shake of the head, perceiving them as unrealistic and asleep at the wheel. As soon as other people see that they are not going to deal with the issues in their lives and that any effort to help them will be futile, those efforts quickly come to a halt. Hidden in this grouping is a type called the mask. Ironically, the energy with which these people try to hide the something in their lives is very often what makes it obvious that they are, in fact, hiding something. Yet, efforts by the world to break through the mask are met with withdrawal and more overt deceit, and others justifiably conclude that what you see is not at all what you get. Other people's extreme distrust of mask people prevents the mask from ever truly succeeding. For the mask, meaningful relationships are virtually impossible. Jekyll and Hyde probably needs little introduction. As the name implies, these people are totally unpredictable. The same person to whom you disclose your vulnerability on one day may prove the next day to be totally unworthy of emotional trust. People learn that the Jekyll and Hyde will blow up. The resulting barrier of fear and distrust creates unbelievable problems for the Jekyll and Hydes of the world. At almost the opposite end of the continuum is the goody-two-shoes. In the real world, some people have less than pure hearts and motives. But goody-two-shoes types are unbelievably blind to this fact. It's as if they're determined to be innocent without assuming any obligation to be wise. They squirm at the sound of off-color language like golly darn or gee whiz. They behave in such a prudish manner that they're out of the mainstream of life. I'm not talking about people of genuine moral fiber, but instead about those who attempt to impose an extreme, unrealistic standard on themselves or others. Perhaps the only ones to exceed the goody-two-shoes of the world are those called perfecto. These people have taken it upon themselves to be perfect, unlike the rest of us. They present this objective as though it were a virtue. They have to be perfect. In fact, their mission statement is characterized by arrogance and condescension. They don't expect you to be perfect, only themselves. Ergo, they are way better than you. You can be flawed, while they must be pristine perfect. But because there is no perfection, these people are constantly frustrated. They never, ever reach their standard. Although their days are characterized by constant, unrealistic self-degradation and little joy, they brag, "I am a perfectionist." The world says, "Get a life." We all know Chicken Little. The world is coming to an end, and these people know it. Whether it's at work, at home, in their relationships, the economy, or the weather, a collapse is imminent. And as sure as God is in His heaven, it's going to be horrible. These people are anxious and urgent. They play the game of life with sweaty palms. They go from one imagined crisis to another. Others find their histrionics irritating and tiresome. Not to be outdone are the whiners. For these people, nothing, I mean nothing, is okay. It's too hot or it's too cold. It's too far, they're too tired. It's too hard. As the saying goes, these people would bitch if they were hung with a new rope. Nobody pays attention to or cares about them enough. Life is not fair. They didn't get the same deal or the same treatment as everybody else. Whine, whine, whine. These people experience the world as an agonizing and very personal ordeal. In response, the people around them want to slap them and scream, "Shut up and deal with it," but mainly just shut up. And last on our list are the guilt mongers. These folks have figured out that guilt is a prod, a weapon to be used in controlling and manipulating others. They use guilt to keep other people down. They may whine or be a martyr, but either way, you have hurt them tragically, and for your transgressions, you get a life sentence of guilt and shame for who you are or what you think and feel. As you worked your way through these personality profiles, you may have found yourself, or at least found some images with which to describe your style of interacting with others. What I'm challenging you to recognize is that that style contributes to your experience of the world. I'll bet you found a lot of other people you know in these profiles as well. I hope this gives you some insight about how and why different people experience the world as they do. Once you acknowledge and embrace the second life law, you stop being a victim. It's like sitting alone in a moving car. You cannot not drive and expect anything besides a crash. Take the wheel. Begin to consciously, purposefully, and actively create experiences that you do want instead of suffering through experiences that you don't want. And here's a hint. I cannot think of a single time in my life where my experience has been enriched or the quality of my life enhanced by my saying no. I can think of dozens of times where my life has been enhanced simply because I said, okay, sure, I'll give it a try. Whether it was saying yes to a movie or a play I didn't think I would like, or saying yes to going to college, I discovered those new heights only when I was willing. I never, ever got more of what I wanted by letting my judgmental, apathetic, tired nature win out. Be a willing spirit. Lean forward. That doesn't mean that you are to suspend good judgment or take reckless risk in the name of willingness. If someone is saying, hey, try some cocaine, you'll love it, that's obviously not the time to be a willing spirit. Tell them to go blow their own nose. But you know what I'm talking about. Break out of your habitual doldrums. Climb up out of that rut and look around. You might really be surprised. Life law number 3. People do what works. Your strategy? Identify the payoffs that drive your behavior and that of others. Control the payoffs to control your life. Christopher, 10 years old, loves the independence of using his bike as real transportation. Today, he stops at the park to play basketball on the way home from his piano lesson. He's done it many times before. He knows he will be late, and he knows his mother will worry greatly. He loves his mother and doesn't want her to worry, but he stops nonetheless. At 26 years old, Caitlin has already lost her mother and 2 grandparents to cancer. It scares her to think that she may be predisposed to the disease herself. She thinks about this as she tears open her second package of cigarettes for the day. Jason is on a second probation with the law and a third probation with the NFL. He will make $3.26 million this year, but only if he plays. The girl he's with wants to go home. He knows he should let her, but he doesn't. He knows it's wrong to keep her against her will. His mother will be as disappointed as anyone. Even so, he locks the hotel room door and begins to unbutton his shirt. Barry and Kay know it hurts their children to see and hear them fight so violently. After 9.5 years of marriage, they know that discussing money problems at home, after long days at work, will deteriorate into a knockdown, drag-out fight. Tonight, you can cut the tension with a knife. Even so, neither disengages. Neither one suggests that they should discuss it another time. The fight is on. Kimberly would give anything to be petite again. She has gained 75 pounds. Her appearance is everything. She hates her body and desperately works to have makeup and hair perfect, as though it will compensate for the unwelcome pounds. She lies in bed, in the dark, and eats her 5th candy bar. If you are at all like me or one of the people in the stories you just heard, I know there have been hundreds, maybe thousands of times that you too have said or done things, perhaps repeatedly, only to shake your head in frustration and disbelief. You may have said to yourself, "What is wrong with me? Why in the world do I keep doing that? I hate that, and I hate myself when I do it, so why do I do it?" Good questions. Why do you do that? The answer is in the current law. And it is a law that, like the others, is highly reliable. You do those things because at some level they work. At some level you perceive that the apparently unwanted behaviors do in fact serve a purpose. As you heard about Christopher, Caitlin, Jason, Barry and Kay, and Kimberly, did you notice a pattern in their lives that is present in your own? All were doing things that on some level they did not want to do. All were doing things with a conscious awareness that negative and unwanted consequences for themselves and others were sure to occur. Nonetheless, they persisted in their undesirable behavior, just as you persist in yours. Is it possible that at some level their behavior was working, in that it was generating payoffs for them? By now, it should be exceedingly clear that the behaviors you choose create the results you get. If you repeat the behaviors, then by definition, those results must be desirable, or you wouldn't do the behavior over and over. Conversely, if you do not repeat the behavior, then the result was not desirable. In other words, there was nothing in it for you. Imagine touching a hot stove. Definite, undesirable result. Thus, no repetition. It should be equally clear, then, that when you change behaviors, you change the results. If you really do get that, you now know that if you can do different, you will have different. Thus, you've taken a huge step towards changing your life. Knowing what you need to do and knowing how to do it are two very different things. Unfortunately, some behaviors, often those that we most hate and want to eliminate, are the very ones that stubbornly continue to occur. But how could that be? Why would you, as a free-thinking, rational human being, repeatedly do what you hate and that causes you such pain? It is an understatement to say that that defies logic. Surely no rational person would do what they don't want to do. Surely no rational person would behave in a way that generated results that they do not want or that keep them from getting results they do want. No matter how rational and logical you may think you are, you know that that's exactly what you do. Understanding how to eliminate this seemingly illogical behavior is critical to improving your life. And you can do it through at least two important methods. You can start behaving in the positive ways necessary to have what you want, or just as importantly, stop behaving in ways that interfere with your having what you want. You cannot eliminate your negative behavior without understanding why you do it to begin with. Only then will you know what buttons to push to get the desired change in your own behavior and that of others. The truth is, you don't and won't behave in ways that generate only negative, unwanted results. You mindlessly do these things because at some level you perceive that it works for you. By works for you, I mean you get some kind of payoff for performing the seemingly undesirable acts. And, as you will see, this formula holds true even if at some other, perhaps more conscious or apparent level, you recognize that the behavior in question isn't working for you. You may even see that it creates pain. Yet, based on results, you are getting some sort of payoff, or you wouldn't do what you do or accept what you accept. A simple example is overeating. At a conscious, rational level, you know it is counterproductive. But at some other level, it is rewarding you enough to maintain the overeating. So, based on results, since people only do what works, overeating must work for you in some way. That is literally what this life law says. If you did not perceive the behavior in question to serve some purpose, to generate some value to you, you would not do it, plain and simple. You must apply this truth at the most literal level. If you are engaging in some behavior or pattern of behavior, you must assume that no matter how strange or illogical it may seem, you are engaging in it in order to create some result that you want. And this is true whether you want to want it or not. People are shaped by their world in exactly the same way. Reflect on your children's earliest years. You probably inadvertently shaped your child's behaviors in ways you wish you had not. For example, many parents, when they hear their child screaming bloody murder from his crib, race in and supply a reward to the screaming behavior by scooping up the child and comforting him. In the child's logic, screaming behavior brings about comfort and pleasure. Soon, he uses that behavior to get that kind of result from his parents. It makes you wonder what behavior you are maintaining through inadvertent rewards in other relationships, doesn't it? If you think you are different, that you are not controlled by receiving payoffs for some behaviors and not others, if you believe that you are an exception to this life law, you are wrong. If you can't identify the payoffs, you just haven't analyzed the situation thoroughly enough and haven't looked hard enough. You may not have realized what you or others perceive to be a reward. The challenge is to consider all the possible ways you could be getting paid off without being aware of it. The currency of life can be one of a number of different kinds of payoffs. You may or may not be aware of what form your payoffs are taking. It is possible, for example, that you are feeding off some kinds of payoffs that may be extremely unhealthy, such as self-punishment, distorted self-importance, vindictiveness, or some other emotionally unstable response. The most obvious and easily measured payoffs are predictably monetary. That's the primary reason we go to work every day when we would rather stay home with our children or sleep all morning. But there are other, even more powerful payoffs that are non-monetary. Psychological income, for example, can take the form of acceptance, approval, praise, love, companionship, greed, punishment, or fulfillment. These payoffs act powerfully to condition you to repeat the behaviors that bring them about. Spiritual income is a payoff that can manifest itself in terms of peace, a sense of connectedness with a higher power, or feelings of righteousness and morality. Physical income is the often powerful sense of physical well-being that comes from good nutrition, exercise, proper weight management, and healthy sexual activity. In the less healthy vein, physical income can be derived from physically intimidating or dominating another, or from being preoccupied with one's own body, either negatively or positively, as with body weight or self-inflicted pain. These incomes, too, can be highly influential in driving behavior. Achievement income has its currency as well. A feeling of accomplishment, recognition from others within one's field of endeavor, or an inner awareness of a job well done. Less positive is the same income in the context of measuring one's self-worth solely as a function of work-related performance, the income of the workaholic. Social income derives from feeling that you are part of a group, and of course increases when you feel you not only